This episode of The Tome Show is sponsored by Noble Knight Games, where Out of Print is available again, Sentinels of the Multiverse, a cooperative superhero card game, and listeners like you. Thanks for using the Tome's Amazon store. Welcome to the Tome Book Club for October 2011. I'm your Tome host, Tracy Hurley.
And I'm your co-host, Jeff Greiner. In each book club episode, we discuss one D&D-related novel, spoilers be damned, in full book club-style conversation. And our book for this month is Neverwinter, the book two in the Neverwinter trilogy by R.A. Salvatore. And we managed to chat with Mr. Salvatore in this episode as well, and you'll get to hear that later on. But for now, let's talk Neverwinter. Tracy, you loved it. Your first ever experience with Drizzt, and it was fantastic. You're hooked, and you want to go back and read them all.
Isn't that what Dahlia says in it?
She wants to take them all. Yeah, this book is a little sexier than I remember his previous books being.
Well, and it's not just Dahlia. Like, they all kind of get it on a little bit in the book.
Yeah, there's a lot of sex.
There's scratches on the back.
There's a succubus, and that involves a lot of sex.
Yep. Succubus and the sorceress and the champion.
And Gestry, whose name you keep forgetting over and over again.
Yeah, he's kind of Gestry. I will not be saying his name. So there's that, and then there's Dahlia and Drizzt. And there's other stuff, too. It's kind of weird.
It's a very sexy book.
Yeah.
For an author who likes to write for middle school kids, right?
Well, to be honest, I was a little surprised about that. Because I remember listening to him say that, you know, in public, how he likes to write for middle school kids. And here we have a book full of sex, S&M, rape, genitalia, genital mutilation.
There's genital mutilation? Did I forget about that?
Maybe when Gestry gets made into the real champion with the living mummy stuff, they talk about how he doesn't have certain bits anymore.
Right.
So.
There is genital mutilation.
And I was like, okay.
It's a dirty, dirty book. And I mean, in fairness, the audience for Drizzt books has grown up, right?
Right.
So I don't have a problem with that, but you're right. He has said that he wants to keep his books accessible to a teenage audience, you know?
Right.
So I guess, I mean, if you're a teenage audience and you start at the beginning of the series, then this is like book 28 or whatever in the series. You know, by the time you get to it, you'll be ready for that, right? But I guess, this book certainly is not very early teen friendly. I mean, I guess as an early teen, I totally would have read it and not had a bit of a problem with it. But I think if my parents had read it prior to me reading it, they may have had a problem with me reading it, if that makes sense.
Mm, I could see that.
Like, it's the kind of book that I don't feel like a middle school reader would actually have a problem reading, but the parents wouldn't approve.
I guess. I don't know. I kind of had some problems reading it, but I think it's because it felt a lot of times like some of the scenes made it clear that, to me at least, that I didn't feel like I was the intended audience for it. Like, it was very, I don't know.
Are you trying to say that you're not a 13-year-old boy?
Yeah, I guess that's probably true. Although sometimes I do act like one. Like, I like laughing at the jokes and everything too, but when one of the big scenes kind of big scenes is the two women, the succubus and the sorceress, kind of sharing a laugh over the scratches on the back of Jestri's back while he's still sleeping. It's just kind of like, you know, that just doesn't appeal to me.
Now, you may have also had some accessibility issues, given that every female character in the entire story, or at least every named female character in the entire story, was either a villain or a pretty serious, how do I say it without being blue, jerk. Huge jerk.
Right. I mean, most of the female... So, it makes sense on one hand, I think, because, was it Valindra, Sylora, and Dahlia were all kind of together before, right?
Right, yeah, yeah. Valindra was originally a wizard in... a wizardess, I guess, in Luskan, and then became a lich right before the spell plague, and was always sort of an evil villainess there, and both Dahlia and Sylora are from Thay, and Thay is an evil empire run by an archlich, so.
Right. And other than Valindra being a little crazy, she's the crazy one, right?
Mm-hmm.
I had a really hard time keeping the female characters straight. Because they didn't seem that different to me.
Okay.
I guess Arunika is a little bit different, but she's also very... evil-ish, so, or at least very neutral.
Yeah, well, and she's certainly not neutral. I mean, she's a devil, right?
Yeah.
I think she would very easily fall into the realm of evil. I didn't have an issue with Arunika, but I also had the advantage of the previous novel that introduced these characters.
Right.
And so that helped me. I guess in this book, it wasn't an issue for me to keep them separate because I already had the different characters pretty well separated in my head. Valindra, we actually met 2 books ago, maybe 3 books ago. Right. So she's fairly well established. So yeah, I mean, I guess I didn't have that problem. And I think the trick with Dahlia is that it is her appearance. That's what really sort of – when you first meet her, her appearance is so striking and strange and almost alien and abrasive in a way that – it was hard for me to forget who she was, you know, because they introduce her as this, you know, lithe, dexterous, you know, kind of sexy elven woman who with a completely shaved head except for this big long braid coming down it and wearing very sort of strange clothes and just full of anger and hate and so not like she there's so much potential there for her to be really attractive, and then she does everything in her power to not be. You know, tattoos all over her face and head. So, yeah, I mean, her...
And yet all the characters seem to think of her as attractive.
They do. At least Driss does, which never made sense to me, because she comes off as somebody very unattractive, and part of that's her personality, too. But at the same time, I get the impression that what he was going for here is a little bit how... And typically the cliche goes the other direction, right? Where girls always go for the bad guy, the bad boy, so to speak. I sort of feel like that's sort of what Salvatore was trying to do with this situation, only in reverse. Where Driss had the good girl, right? He'd been married, and she was very sweet and nice and loving and very moral and ethical and all those things. And now he's you know, she's gone, and it's been 100 years, and he's kind of intrigued by this kind of walking on the edge sort of thing. So
yeah, I guess but like you said, the only difference you could really tell me there was her appearance. Like, as a character, I didn't find her all that much different to me than the other two. Like, Valindra's the crazy one, okay, and Dahlia's the one who has this woad thing going on. Other than their appearance, and then you have the lich, right, is the other one?
The lich is Valindra.
Oh, Valindra, okay. Then the sorceress.
Right. Yeah, I can see, yeah, I mean, there's some similarities there, or threads that tie through them. Like, I don't think I could ever get Dahlia and Valindra mixed up, because they're very different in terms of where they're from and who they are and what their goals are.
But I think maybe from other books than from the one I'm on?
That may be. And I don't have that perspective.
Yeah. to me, it's like they all use their body to get what they want, and it's like, yay, yay.
Cool. Valencia doesn't use her body to get what she wants at ever.
I don't know.
Her body's rotting.
I know.
Nobody's attracted to her, but she doesn't care.
Okay, so she's the only one that's different, but we don't see her. Like, she's in there a bit, but she's usually just saying crazy stuff. But Arunica does.
Arunica, well, she's a succubus. That's what succubi do.
I don't know.
So I don't have a problem with her doing it.
Who was with Arunica that night?
Sylora. Sylora's the main baddie of this book.
Yeah.
And I think there are some similarities between Sylora and Dahlia, and those are intentional. Because when they were first introduced in the previous book, they were kind of two sides of the same coin.
Yep.
And they were competitors, right? And that's why they hated each other so much, even when they were on the same side, is they hated each other because they were both trying to work their way up the ranks and saw the other one as a competitor.
Right.
So I think there's some purposeful similarities there. And there's some obvious differences, right? One uses magic and the other one hits you with a stick.
And both put scratches on your back.
you really get hung up on the sex thing, huh?
I don't know. It just felt... I don't mind. Like, I like having sex in my books, but it just felt very immature to me. So I think that's what I'm hung up on.
Okay. I mean, I didn't... I sort of... those things happened, and I kind of blew past them pretty quickly. So it didn't... I was more hung up on some of the character stuff and some of the interactions between some of the characters. Like, I really liked Arunica because you don't really know where she's coming from or what she's doing, right? She's playing... She's playing two sides of a conflict that has like seven sides, you know. And in fact, one of the things I liked about this story is that there's a lot of different sides, and none of them, you know, you don't have the black and white, the good versus evil, like you've had in some previous books. You don't have the righteous dwarves of Mithril Hall versus the horrible creatures from the Underdark, like you had in a previous book, right?
Right.
You've got seven different, you know, and I exaggerate. You have what, four or five different factions, and they're all trying to accomplish something in Neverwinter, and they're all in competition with each other to do that.
Right, and that's part of, with Arunica, that was part of the reason that I said maybe she's slightly neutral, is more that she doesn't really care who she aligns with as long as she gets what she wants out of it.
No, see, I think she's playing her own game. I think
well, that's what I mean.
I think she's playing both sides against each other, and I don't know. I don't know if she maybe has her own goal in mind that's different than either one, and she's using everybody to get to that goal.
Right.
Yeah. And I really like Valindra too, because Valindra is one of those characters that you know you mentioned over and over again that she's crazy, right? But at the same time, they at times they hinted, and at other times they outright said, she's crazy, but she's not nearly as crazy as she seems. Like
she plays it up.
She's a lot more sane than she makes you think, and you can see that in the way she acts. And you know, her words may be one thing, but her actions are very purposeful.
Isn't it Barabbas, or how do you pronounce his name?
Uh-huh.
Isn't he one of the ones that sees it or something? I know there's a specific character that tests her to see how crazy he is.
He may have, and that sounds like something he would do. Although I know at one point even Sylora says it to one of the other Thayans, you know, don't count, you know, you say she's crazy, but don't count her out. She knows what she's doing better than you think.
Plus so. There's the sovereignty that's going into her mind.
Yeah, and see, there's another faction involved here. It is like they said, who are all the villains of the Forgotten Realms? None of which are in Neverwinter. Let's find a reason to put him here, you know?
Right.
And ironically, the one faction that has been hit upon in the realms, you know, the evil faction that's been hit upon in the realms fairly regularly, that's not involved in what's going on in Neverwinter, but still plays prominently in the books, are the High Captains of Luskan. Like, they're next door, and they're not doing anything with Neverwinter. But meanwhile, the Thayans, which are on the quite literal opposite side of the continent, have a huge faction over there.
Right.
It's crazy.
It is crazy.
I mean, you've got the Netherese, you've got the Thayans, and you've got the Abolethic Sovereignty all being involved in what's going on there. Not to mention the people in Neverwinter, the people just trying to make a go of it. And in theory, the Drow. You might see more from the Drow as well with Jarl Axel, if he ever returns.
Isn't he dead?
And by if, I mean when.
Yeah. So it was kind of weird because they were talking about that whole time, like, Jaraxxle is dead. And I think, was that covered in the book before, and that's why I didn't know about it?
Yeah, yeah. He quote, died towards the end of Gontalgrim in sort of the big climactic battle. But he died because they saw him fall and could conceive of no way that he could have survived. And it's been a year since I've read it, but as I recall, the reader knows that he got out, that there was an escape, right. There was an escape plan, or somebody jumped in and saved him or whatever. But, we as readers are pretty confident he's alive, even though none of the other characters know it, which is good because Jaraxxle is probably, one of my favorite characters in the whole series. I probably like Jaraxxle more than I do Drizzt. Although it's not and you and I have talked about this off the air. It's not unusual for me in a Drizzt book to like the supporting cast more than I do Drizzt himself.
Right.
You know, I enjoy exploring Dahlia and Barabbas / Artemis and Triri and Herzgo Allegni and Valyndra a lot more than I do exploring Drizzt yet again for the 30th time.
Right. I think one of the things that kind of bugged me about it was Dahlia's story doesn't seem all that unique to me, and maybe that's the reason why I don't see her as that unique of a character in the book. But
yeah, and again, I think you missed a lot of her character development. I mean, we got a lot of her background, and I think I shared some of it with you the other night. But you got a lot of her background in the previous one, and some of her history with Herzgo Allegni that made her into the cold-hearted person that she is.
Right, and part of that history is just something that's done so often in fantasy that it just kind of bugs me at this point.
Oh, okay. See, in my fantasy reading, I'm primarily reading D&D-based books these days.
Right.
Because that's what I have time for. And it's not an overly common trope there.
Right.
So, maybe because it's aimed for a bit of a younger audience typically, but...
Right. So, what else should we talk about?
I don't know.
Living Mummy?
Yeah, I mean, he's not... He never felt particularly important anyway. He's sort of the monster of the week, right? He's not...
Yeah, I just felt kind of bad. Because, like, we set him up as this big champion thing, right? Like, that he gets set up that way, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then it's like, oh, well, and it doesn't really matter because she's not... And we can talk about this later after the author interview if you want.
Well, go ahead.
Well, so because we talked to Ari Salvatore about this, and he sets up this champion. He goes through this horrendous ritual to basically become a living mummy with the skin of the Umber Hulk, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Around him. And everything about him is set up to defeat Dahlia. And then he gets told right before then, like, oh yeah, and Dahlia's not even... the best warrior there. She's probably the least important, like, not least important, but least skilled warrior. And he's like, I just did what for what? You know what I mean?
Like, well, he was always a little bit tragic anyway, right? I mean, this is the guy who was completely love-struck by this person who outwardly abused him and didn't care anything about him and made it clear to him, I don't care anything about you.
Passed him around, and when he said that I love you, goes into this whole thing about the lust and Asmodeus and blah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, she clearly never cared anything about him and was using him as a tool. I mean, in fairness, I think she was pretty upfront and honest to him about it, you know?
Right.
I think he's so broken, like, I don't know, I have a hard time sympathizing with the guy at all because he's so not, like, okay, first of all, anybody who's willing to dedicate their life to an archdevil of greed and power and all that, right? They're already broken. And then to dedicate yourself to this woman who outwardly tells you that you're just a means to an end,
right?
And yet continue to be dedicated to him, you know, to her, whatever, you know, this is not somebody I feel overly sympathetic to. You knew you were a tool from the beginning. So if you find out you weren't as important of a tool as you thought you were, you're a sucker. Too bad, you know?
I guess. I was like, I thought I was reading one story, and then suddenly it went another direction, and I don't know. I was kind of meh.
Oh, okay. See, I don't know. I felt like it was exactly the story I expected it to be, but again, this is my 28th or 30th R.I. Salvatore book, so I kind of understand his story construction maybe a little bit better.
Yeah.
Like, it was pretty clear to me exactly what was going to happen and how it was – not exactly how, but, you know, I had a pretty good idea about where the thing was going, and
right.
It went there.
Oh, yeah. It just seemed weird, though, because, you know, he said that Solora kind of wanted to get back at – like, wanted Dahlia for herself to mm-hmm. get back at, but then doesn't, like, send her a champion instead, and I don't know.
Yeah.
I think that's the part that didn't quite match up to me.
Okay, well, why don't we go to the interview?
Okay.
And then we can come back and chit-chat a little bit more about that.
So before we talk to the author, R.A. Salvatore, she mentioned our Noble Knight games. Noble Knight is a game store both online and in the real world, and they specialize in finding out-of-print games, game stuff,
game
just
stuff.
For you.
Swag, booty.
And our pick for this episode is The Legend of Dritz Scenario Pack.
Yeah, it is.
It has... What?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Actually, I own this one. It's pretty awesome with the big white dragon. And, oh yeah, Dritz and some other people, too.
Wolfgar. Who was not in this book, and you've never read a story with him. So I suppose you're allowed to not know who he is.
If you really like Dritz and like this book, you should probably pick it up. It's about, what, $60?
Yeah, it's a little less than $60. Which, I mean, for the dragon is probably what pretty typical price for a dragon mini. And it's not just a dragon mini. It's a big one. It's one of those giant ones that they made back in the day. And long out of print. 4 years out of print.
Nice.
And still available at Noble Knight.
Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. With a huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more. Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.noblenight.com or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items.
We are now here with R.A. Salvatore, and we are talking about Neverwinter. Welcome back to the show, sir. We talked to you about a year ago about the first book in the series.
Yeah, I remember. It's good to be back.
Very good. I guess... A good place to start off with is from your perspective, what is Neverwinter about?
It's a revenge book. Pretty much picks up right after the story of Gontalgrim, and at the end of that book, obviously Dritz is not in a good place. He's pretty angry. Some bad things happened, and his new companion, who seems to always be angry, is not in a good place. And so it's not hard for him to follow her down the road of revenge against the person that caused them both to be angry.
Very good. Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, beyond that, the book is about further exploring all the weavings of the different factions that have shown up in this region.
Yeah, very cool. And it's worth noting, before we get too far into it, we are recording this for a book club discussion. Given that it's a book club and not a review or any of that, we don't mind the spoilers and that kind of stuff. People are very aware of what they're getting into.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Yeah, spoil away.
Now, I'm curious. We have an interesting perspective here tonight because this is Tracy's first Dritz novel ever. And so she's kind of jumping in a little late in the game, I think, in the story, in more ways than one. But I'm kind of curious, what do you do as you're writing these books to try to make... I mean, every book is going to be somebody's first exposure, right? So do you do some things to try to make it not too difficult for new people to jump in?
Yeah, a lot of things. I mean, first of all, it kind of blows my mind when I think about the average reader coming to my work if they're picking up The Crystal Shard or Homeland. Is younger than the book.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a humbling perspective, making me feel kind of old here. But what I do is really with the Dark Elf books, I've followed more the James Bond, Sherlock Holmes structure. I'm just following these guys down the road, of adventure and telling you about the next big thing that comes along, whether it's Dritz or his friends or his enemies. And so I've tried to make each book have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And there are deeper lines, storylines, particularly with the characters that filter through book to book. So there's logical progression. But you should be able to pick up just about any book in the series and not get lost with the main story you're being told. Hopefully you'll be intrigued enough about the characters to want to go back and see where it all came from. But you know, I've been doing that consciously for a long time. And unlike some of the other series out there, if you look at what Steven Erickson's doing or George Martin or Robert Jordan with The Wheel of Time, you can't pick up the eighth book in The Wheel of Time, I don't think.
Sure.
And
sure.
Just read it cold. I mean, you'd be lost. But with Dritz books, I think you can pick up any one of them and at least have a good, fun adventure story.
Cool.
Tracy, you got anything?
No.
Okay.
You just read it.
I didn't want to step on her toes, but
I think there's a fair bit that I got. The first few chapters were kind of hard for me, because they were already kind of in motion. It feels like stuff from the previous novel. But I think overall I got most of it.
Well, good. That's what I tried for.
One of the things that she and I talked about a little bit just before you called was the foreshadowing of sort of the big reveal of who Barabbas is, and that as I'm reading through the book and as somebody who's read all the books, I'm reading through the book and I'm like, hey, there seemed to be an awful lot of Artemis's stuff in this book. It seems strange that Artemis isn't there, and then of course he is. I'm curious, had you been foreshadowing that since the first book and we just didn't notice it as much? Because it was definitely much more obvious this time around. Tracy even mentioned that not really knowing who Artemis is, she had started to figure out who it was.
Well, here's the thing. I didn't try to hide it. There wasn't supposed to be a mystery. I was just telling the story honestly from the perspective of the people involved. And until this book, until Dritz met Artemis again, even Artemis was referring to himself as Barabbas.
Mm-hmm.
So it's funny because if you go to like my message board, the people who like study the books and really, you know, if I get something wrong in the books, they're the ones who'll let me know in no uncertain terms. They knew right away. They had threads. Of course it's Artemis. Who else could it be? Look at all the clues. And someone asked me, why didn't you make it more mysterious? Like in the book Passage to Dawn, we knew that someone was coming back from the dead or from captivity with a demon lord, actually. And was it Wolfgar or was it Zacnaphane? That was kind of a mystery about the novel. But I wasn't trying to do that with Barabbas at all. It was, for the people who paid attention, it would have been fairly easy, I think, to at least start thinking it might be, if not figuring it out entirely. I mean, some of the clues were pretty straightforward. I don't even want to call them clues.
Right.
But it didn't matter to me either way. For some people, it came as a big surprise. For other people, they knew it was coming. But it didn't matter to me either way. I wasn't trying to play that mystery game on anyone. I wasn't going to throw any red herrings down or some diversions here or there or make it really obtuse. That wasn't my point in that.
Okay. Now, I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about the decision to bring Artemis back, if you will, in as much as he never really went away, if you follow the story. Because it seems like a lot of the, I guess I say a lot, you and Ed Greenwood, who have written novels about the same characters pre-Spell Plague and post-Spell Plague, have had a tendency to try to pull some characters, not all obviously, but pull some characters from before to after that otherwise would have a hard time doing that. And I'm curious about the decision-making process. You know, did you always intend on bringing him 100 years into the future?
I didn't intend to go 100 years in the future.
Sure.
Because you got to start with that. When I wrote, the last book that really featured Artemis was Road of the Patriarch.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought Road of the Patriarch was a great ending for Adamus and Treri. Mm-hmm. There was a moment of redemption. I mean, they went into Memnon and they burned down a church and killed a bunch of really evil priests. And at the end of it, you know, I've got Treri with one of the priests who got out, basically saying to him, so, because this guy wasn't a dirtbag like the rest of them. And he basically said to him, so, go back and rebuild your church. Only this time, do what you say you're going to do and follow the tenets of that God you claim you love. If you do that, I'll leave you alone. But if you go back there and do the same thing that these dirtbags were doing, I'll come back and I'll burn the church down again, and this time you'll be in it. And so I figured that was like, who but Adamus and Treri could find redemption in threatening the life of a priest? It just seemed perfect to me. And also, he dismissed Jarl Axel. And the reason he dismissed Jarl Axel is because he didn't need him anymore. Because for the first time in his life, Adamus and Treri could look into a mirror and not hate what he saw. So I thought that was going to be the end of Adamus and Treri. But then I started getting tons of email about the character from people. And some of them were revealing pretty intimate details about childhood trauma and saying it wasn't enough for them. And this was one after the other. It was almost like an orchestrated thing. There were so many of them. But one after another, they were saying, it's not enough for me to see, to have the hope that Adamus and Treri will find some peace. I have to see it. And if it was an orchestrated campaign, they did a good job because they convinced me that maybe I did want to see it too. So I had no intention of being done with Artemis. I mean, initially I did with Road of the Patriarch. I figured that could be the end, but I had no intention of being done with him. And there were things I still wanted to explore. And when, you know, they decided to make the 100-year jump, and I'm sure Ed feels this way, part of the charm of the series that we've both been writing, part of the loyal readership, if you will, is people have fallen for these characters. They like these characters. And it's very jarring to all of a sudden throw them all to the side. Except for the main protagonist or whatever. So, it's a magical world. Things can happen. And I decided that he was going to be one of the people coming into this new phase of Drizzt. Because what's going on now is, you know, for all his life, for almost all of the books, except for the parts of the first one, really, Drizzt has surrounded himself with people of similar moral character, you know, people whose compass pointed in the same direction as his. Now, all of a sudden, with Dalia and Treri, that's not necessarily the case. In fact, it's definitely not the case. And so the question is, you know, when you have a friend who starts hanging around with a bad crowd, or you have a family member who falls in love with someone you know is bad for them. So the question is he going to lift them up or are they going to drag him down? And I don't know the answer, which makes the writing fun for me. And who better to do it than Treri? I mean, really.
Absolutely. So should we expect to see Treri around for a while then?
Well, I can tell you he's in the next book, certainly. I'm almost done writing it, and he's certainly there.
Okay. Yeah, I think you go two ways with the introduction of Treri into the post Spellplug world here, this 100-year jump, because on one hand you're right, you know, I like the character and I missed the character, but on the other hand you did sort of give him a swan song, you know, he had his moment to fade away in Road to the Patriarch, and so now we find out not only did he not find peace, but things are very not peaceful, you know.
Well, there's two kinds of peace. I mean, I don't think he found peace in his physical day-to-day existence because obviously he got mired in something really bad and became a slave for almost a century. That can't be good. But internally, I think it can be worse if you don't find that internal peace of who you are. And has he found that? I think to some degree he has. And I think you see he seems a little less angry in these books.
It's true.
And certainly he's angry at Allegni. I mean, he hates the guy.
Mm-hmm.
And who wouldn't? But if you see him in those moments when he's not talking about Allegni, he doesn't seem quite as angry as he was in the earlier books.
Yeah,
and that's because he can look in the mirror now.
Yeah, I think that's true. He doesn't seem as angry, although he certainly doesn't seem at peace, either physically or emotionally, just because he's had this burden of enslavement, and you know, it seems like he would like nothing more than to just die and go away, and he can't.
We shall see.
Okay.
I don't mind spoiling Neverwinter because everyone's read it, but
sure.
What's going on next is none of your business.
That's right. We'll bring you back next year and find out. What was I going to say? Oh, I was going to ask you about names a little bit. One of the things I've noticed throughout your writing, especially recently, I noticed in this book and Gontalgrim, you have a tendency to refer to characters either by first name, last name, or both. And, mm-hmm. and you stay very consistent, you know. Herzgo Alegni is almost always referred to as Herzgo Alegni.
Not so much. I mean, I think I do it a lot when I'm doing third-person narrator with him, because that's kind of how he sees himself, as this impressive. There's a rhyme and reason to it.
Right.
Jelvis Grinch, who is the one of the first citizens of Neverwinter, almost always will be referred to as Jelvis Grinch in the books, no matter who's talking. But I don't know. It sort of develops its own characteristics, if you will, with each character. People, it's almost like, do they have a nickname or do they have their full name? You know, am I Bobby or Robert or R.A., right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and sometimes it's for reasons of haughtiness with Herzgo Alegni. He wants people to know Herzgo Alegni. You know what I mean? That's kind of how he sees himself, this complete warlord, tiefling, great hulking monster who can do whatever he wants because he's Herzgo Alegni. With Intrary, it goes back and forth. I usually refer to him as just Intrary. I usually refer to Dritz just as Dritz. But the other time, when I have characters who are kind of important but are going to show up intermittently through the books, sometimes I will do that, like with Jelvis Grinch, and I'll use both names. First of all, I just like the way it sounds when I'm reading it. I think it sounds it makes it fit better in the story and the pacing of the book. But even beyond that, it helps to remind the readers, I think, more of the character.
Well, and you wouldn't want to just refer to him as Grinch. People might think you're Dr. Seuss.
Hey, that wouldn't be a bad If they're going to think you're someone else, it might as well be someone like that.
Sure. I'm curious. This book hints a lot at stories that haven't been told.
Absolutely.
And I'm curious, some of those I feel like, you know, we've gotten sort of the flashbacks. You know, like, for example, what happened with Artemis? How did he end up with Netheril? How, you know, the falling out with Jarl Axel? That didn't take place between the pages of a book,
right?
Are those, some of those like that feel like they're stories that could yet be told? They could almost have their own books to them to explain what happened. Some of them I feel like we're going to get more through flashbacks and things that'll be enough. Sort of like I assume we're going to hear more about the relationship between Efron and Herzgo Alegni, for example.
That's a good assumption.
But I mean, do you, are there intentions to go back and look at some of these other stories, not just those ones that happen through flashbacks, but like what happened with Intrieri and Jarl Axel?
I don't think overtly there are. I mean, I don't have anything planned right now to go back and do it, but it is job security. I mean, you know, there's always a hook to be told, to be you know, thrown at readers and make them think about it. And I think a little bit of the mystery, as long as you're hinting and giving enough detail so that readers can fill in the blanks or come up with their own stories, I think that's part of what's fun about reading books. I don't think you need to know every minute of every day of someone's life. You know, one of the characters that the people who read my books love the most is Zachnafane, Dritz's father. He was in the book. One. You know nothing about him. But they love that. So, you know, these kind of things where I'm sure it will be revealed either in flashbacks or suppose Intrary and Jarl Axel meets. We're going to hear something about what happened. Or maybe I will go back and write a book about it, depending on how things fall out. I don't know. But I think that's the fun kind of hook for readers as well, because it leads them to speculate. People want things to talk about. These are the kind of things that readers talk about in a long-running series. If I was just giving everybody everything and you know, inviting less participation. Why would anybody talk about the books? They'd maybe read them and enjoy them, but why would anyone talk about them? And having these, you know, what's going to happen with Dritz and Dahlia? You know, is she going to move that diamond to her other ear and try and kill him? Is he going to kill her? What's going to happen? You know, how did Intrary get where he is? Whatever happened between him and Jarl Axel? Why would Jarl Axel sell him out? That's not like Jarl Axel. Or is it? Because after all, he is a mercenary and he's, you know, you can't really call him a good guy. And it just leads to deeper discussion about and understanding of, discussion of and understanding of the characters, I think.
Yeah, very good. I also am intrigued by the idea of what's going to happen when Jarl Axel meets back up with everybody, which I sort of am right now, and obviously I don't want you to spoil me or anything, but right now it looks like that's where things are going. You know, they spent some time in this book looking for Jarl Axel, although that he ended up being more of a MacGuffin than anything. But
well, Dritz needed it. I mean, one of the things I did with Jarl Axel was I foreshadowed Dritz is trying to claim, I'm alone now, I'm free. You know, everything's gone, okay, so be it. I know what it is to be an elf. This is what an Ovindil told me to do several books ago, right? Just live your life in shorter time spans. So now the slate is clean, I'm free, I can do what I want. But then you see, no, he's not. What is one of the first things he does? He convinces Dahlia to go see if Jarl Axel's really dead. He's desperate when they get to Jarl Axel's apartment in Luskan. He wants Jarl Axel to be there. He can't let go of all the ties to his past. He's pretending he can. And to me, that sets up his meeting with Intrary.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the reasons why, instead of saying, you're still alive and trying to kill him, he says, you know, in his heart, he says, oh, man, a tie to my past. Yay.
Well, yeah, right. And even as he's losing ties to his past and finding other ones, he's also creating new ties to other people like Dahlia.
Well, he has to. He has to.
He's, if nothing nothing else, a social creature.
He was probably the most antisocial creature you could think of when he walked away from Menzel Baron Zahn, but he found that wasn't really what he wanted in life.
Mm-hmm.
And then he found love, and he found family, and he found friends, and he liked it. Who wouldn't?
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the themes that was sort of being explored in Gontalgrim that was sort of hinted at once or twice but never really progressed in Neverwinter was the idea of some of those past relationships, Caterbury and Regis, who were theoretically still out there somewhere. Is that going to drive more? Is that story going to drive forward some more, especially as they continue the hunt for Jarl Axel?
Well, they're not really out there. I mean, that's kind of a different type of thing. So,
okay,
you know, I don't think that they're not in my thoughts at this time as I'm writing the next book. I'll put it that way.
Okay. Well, and I was always kind of curious about that because when they went on to their reward. When they died, what, 2-3 books ago?
Mm-hmm.
I had sort of saw that as they had moved on to the afterlife and they were done. But then when Gontalgrim came out, suddenly it was a little bit less sure that they were actually gone. So right now you're thinking that they're gone. They're done with it until later when you decide to pull them out and play with them again.
You're drawing conclusions.
I am. That's what I do.
Nice try, Ace.
Assumes evidence not in.
Okay. There's also a short story in the collected stories that came out. There's a new short story about Wolfgar. Hey, look, isn't part of the allure of an afterlife of being back together with people you love?
Sure.
I mean, isn't that the main thing? Isn't that what's been held over the heads of every human being since religion was invented? Is that you're going to go to a just reward and see the people you loved? So, if I got to send people to their just reward, why would I make it not be nice?
Sure. I'm curious a little bit about as we get into the beginning of the book. You know, it is a Drizzt book, as much as any of them are. It's a book, and it's a book called Neverwinter. But he spends the first half of the book moving the opposite direction away from Neverwinter.
Right.
Now, obviously, some of that is this drive to find these ties to his past, like Jarl Axel. But I'm also curious sort of about that decision, how, you know, the idea of taking the main character of a book that's named for a place and having him not actually be in that place for the vast majority of the book.
Well, Neverwinter refers to the region around the city because you have Neverwinter and Neverwinter Wood.
Mm-hmm.
And he's there. I mean, the climax of the book is in Neverwinter Wood, after all. And you have to understand a couple things about the industry of publishing. One is that they ask the author the name of the book and then name it something else, typically. this series was designed by me to do some things with Drizzt. Put him in a world that has many more shades of gray. You know, when you're living in 10 towns or among the civilization, if you will, 10 towns is kind of a civilization carved out of the wilderness. But, or when you're living in Mithril Hall, you're living in a lawful land. Even 10 towns is a fairly lawful land compared to what they have now. When you live in those situations where the needs of people are being met on a very basic level, it's much easier to have a black and white view of the world. This is good, that is bad. But what happens when the societal breakdowns occur, like we saw in Luskin with the Pirate King when Dudemont fell? What happens when society no longer takes care of the needs of the average person and or makes it impossible for that person to fulfill those needs? And that's what we're seeing. If you look at the beginning of the book when they meet the farmer woman and they're heading up toward Luskin and they meet the highwaymen. Are these highwaymen, they're breaking the law, clearly, but are they doing anything wrong? They're trying to survive. It's like the Les Miserables, right? I mean, when you're stealing food so you don't starve to death, are you really doing something immoral? And that's a big question for Drizzt that he's never really had to face before. Because everywhere he's been, you look at all the places he's been, in one way or another, takes care of the basic needs of the people of the community. It's that societal structure serves. But now that's gone. I couldn't show that just in Neverwinter City, and the book would have been kind of myopic if I had been there. But that's the story I've been trying to tell with Drizzt. Neverwinter got layered on. That's the cake I'm baking with Drizzt. Look at it that way. Neverwinter got layered on as an icing on the cake. Because a couple of years ago, Wizards of the Coast called me up and said, hey, you're going to be anywhere near Neverwinter. And I usually am, because I'm always out by Luskin in these books, because mm-hmm. that's the city I've used the most. And I said, yeah, I'm going to be in the Crags. And they said, well, there's a computer game coming. Neverwinter Nights, there's a new one coming. And we would like you to work some details in. Are there things we can do? So I flew up to Seattle and sat down with the people at Wizards and the people from Cryptic. And they told me, you know, here's what we're doing. And I said, well, I mean, you're going to have all new graphics for the city, right? Yeah. I said, so you want me to knock the city down, basically. And then I came up with this idea of how we could do it, of how we could accomplish putting Neverwinter, the city, the woods, the entire region, in the situation and the state they needed to do the computer game. You see?
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't matter to me because that cake I was baking about Drizzt and the Shades of Grey and Drizzt meeting up with Dahlia and Drizzt going to Gontalgrim with Brunner, that cake was still going to be the exact same cake whether I put this icing on it or not. And so I agreed to do it.
Very good. Now, one of the things I noticed and you've just sort of explained sort of how this ties into the larger branding push that Wizards of the Coast has been doing with Neverwinter. But one of the things maybe it was just my impressions, but this book felt more fourth edition-y, if you will, in its descriptions. You know, magic felt like more like the fourth edition version of Magic, of D&D and how it works and all that, and the way some of the fight scenes were set up felt like this is how I might do that if I was a DM in fourth edition.
Yeah.
And I was kind of curious, was that intentional? It's not like I was reading it and I could see the dice rolling, so to speak, because you don't want that, right? But it certainly, it's one of the things as a gamer and as somebody who reads these books, I'm always thinking about is how would I do this in a game, right? And so it felt a little more fourth edition-y to me this time around than many other books.
Yeah, I did that on purpose. And there wasn't an edict from anyone. But, I mean, look, I'm writing in the world that's based on the Dungeons & Dragons game. I have a responsibility to try somewhat to stay within the boundaries, the limitations, the consistencies, and the logic of whatever magic system they're using or societal system they're using. It's their playground.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, you're right. There was one scene in particular with Efren and Entreri where they ran into some shades in the woods. I mean, some Thayans in the woods. Remember that scene?
Mm-hmm.
That was an anatomically correct 4th edition fight. I had stacks of cards for the characters involved, and I figured out what moves would they do based on these rules. And then I tried to make logical pros sense out of it. And I got to tell you, it was one of the toughest things I've ever done in my life. Because 4th edition is not designed for pros.
Sure.
4th
sure.
edition is designed for game balance. It's designed so that you can take Dungeons & Dragons and make a computer game out of it. That's blatantly obvious. They have class balancing. They have, movement is a big part of the tactics of 4th edition. So how do you shoot someone with an arrow and move them 15 feet toward you? How does that make sense? So when I'm writing and I wanted to get into fourth edition a little bit and see how it played out, that was really the battle scene where I did it more than any other, where I really wanted to see if I could make these cards sound like they made sense in a game setting. I mean, in a novel setting. And it was exhausting. It was brutal. I don't want to ever do it again. But I had to give it a shot.
So does that mean somewhere out there you have stats for Artemis and Entreri as a fourth edition character?
No.
Oh, okay.
No. Are you kidding? I'm starting my new D&D campaign now that I'm back from the road. The group is getting back together again. Next week we're rolling characters after the football game. And we're playing first, so there you go.
Okay. Yeah, I wasn't sure if you were playing more 4th edition, and that's why some of it was coming through or not. But you're still playing 1st edition with your group?
When I DM. When my son's DM, we play 4th.
Okay. Very good. Well, Tracy, I've done most of the talking. Do you have any questions before we let him go?
Well, I guess the one question I had was near the end of the book with the whole setup between the three of them and the champion. I'm forgetting his name right now for some reason.
Jestri?
Yeah, Jestri, set up with Dahlia. It seemed kind of weird to me that suddenly Dahlia was diminished in importance because of the introduction of Entreri. And I was just wondering if you would be willing to explain how that happened or, like, why?
Diminished in... What do you mean by diminished? You have to clarify that a little bit.
Well, so, even Jestri points out, like, you set me up to be the person that goes against Dahlia, but now you're telling me Dahlia is the third most important of those three.
The weakest of the three.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think Dahlia was the least important of the three, but here's the thing about Dahlia. She's really young. She's a kid. And if you're buying into the notion that Entreri has basically stopped in time physically, and you buy into the notion that elves live hundreds of years, so Dritz being 200 is no big deal, right? He's a kid, still physically. Yet he has 190 years of training behind him. And these are seasoned veterans. He and Entreri, by this point, are seasoned veterans. They are deadly. They have been through hundreds of battles. Dahlia's been through a few. She's tough. She's really good. But really, what's best about Dahlia, and you see it the first time in Gontalgrim, which I know you haven't read that yet, but Jeff will help me out here. When when Entreri fights Dahlia, he doesn't know what to make of her because she's got this exotic weapon and she can change her styles of fighting. He's never seen anything quite like that. That's what scares him. But if you're talking about in with regards to I'm trying to remember the book now because remember I'm almost done the next book and that's
I totally
very
understand.
Hard for me. But if you're talking about in regards to who's the best of the fighters, it's really Dahlia is not a match for Dritzler and Treri. Other than the fact that she's got this exotic fighting style. She's going to be if she lives long enough because she's got all the tools, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember the scene.
I mean, were you talking about in terms of battle prowess or were you talking about as a character?
I think I know the scene that she was talking about. There was actually a conversation that Sylora Salm has with some of the people around her, and when they – when they noticed that Entreri had joined them, they sort of came to the conclusion that of the three, Dahlia was the least threatening. Like, this is such a powerful group now with Entreri in it that Dahlia is the least, the smallest threat of the bunch, which I think, maybe I'm wrong in interpreting it this way, but my interpretation was it was less about you diminishing Dahlia and more about you reminding us just how badass Entreri and Drist are.
Well, I mean, they knew how bad Barrett. Remember that Sylora knows much more about Dahlia.
Right.
She knows her very well, and she knows how to beat her, or thinks she does. Dritz, in this area, he's got a hell of a reputation in this particular area of the realms. And he's drow. And that's the one thing that's been missing a lot, I think, from the Forgotten Realms books. Drow strike, you know, of late, of the books of late, because drow have become player characters. Mm-hmm. And in fourth edition, everything got class balanced and race balanced and all of that. But you say the word drow to a person in Faerun, in the Forgotten Realms, and you've just, like, drained the blood from their face, from his face. Because drow are bad. They're really, really, really bad. And people are scared to death of drow. And now you have this drow ranger who has got a reputation of winning a battle in Icewind Dale, of being beside Dúthamont when Luskan fell, of taking out, of being part of the team that took out Arklam Greith, the Lich of Luskan, and brought down the Host Tower of the Arcane. You're talking about a guy who was with King Brunner Battlehammer when they reclaimed Mithril Hall, and was instrumental in allowing the orcs to build their kingdom of many arrows. I mean, his exploits just go on and on and on and on and on. As far as Barabbas goes, they knew how bad this guy was. He was the Legni's champion who was slaughtering Thanes in the forest with ease. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that in that scene, as much as they're diminishing Dahlia to third place, I think Sylora knows Dahlia better than these other two, so she's not as afraid of Dahlia because she's been looking forward to this. The other thing I think, if I'm remembering the scene correctly, is I think Sylora is also trying to make sure a little bit that Dahlia's hers. You know what I mean? Kill mm-hmm. Dritzen and Treri, let me have this one. She hates Dahlia for a lot of reasons that go back to the beginning of the book Gontalgrim. If you remember the beginning of the book Gontalgrim, they shared a lover,
mm-hmm.
Dahlia and Sylora. And Sylora tried to turn him against Dahlia, so Dahlia killed him, like she planned on doing when she left anyway. But even some of the ways, if you look at the way Dahlia treated Sylora with such disrespect. So to me, There is the fact that, you know, Dahlia's got a ways to go before her reputation will scare the hell out of people the way the mention of Dritzler and Treri will, or Barabbas, to anyone who knows them. Yeah, that's there. But I think there's a second level of that. Is Sylora always wanted her crack at Dahlia. She hates her and doesn't think much of her.
Very good. So speaking of Sylora, apparently, Dahlia has never seen any movie ever, because you never leave your hated enemy alive, even just barely, anywhere.
Oh.
I don't know what she was thinking. I mean, it's the one person you want dead in all the world, and you leave him breathing and walk away.
Yeah, but this isn't a Halloween movie.
So are you saying that we're not going to see Sylora anymore?
I'm not saying that.
Okay.
I'd never say anything that's not in the book about what's coming next.
Because I don't know, it seemed to me like the, you know, especially as I oftentimes think of things in game terms, right? As if I'm DMing this campaign, there's no way the Dread Ring isn't keeping Sylora alive and bringing her back to wreak havoc. So.
Oh yeah, I know.
it seemed a little Deus Ex Machina there to say, well, this one time I've hated her for all this time, I wanted her dead, and now I'm just going to leave her to suffer and walk away.
Oh, I think she was more than suffering. I mean, look at the condition she was in. She was going. I mean,
sure.
I mean, she was torn to shreds by the panther. She got hit with several of Drit's arrows. She got hammered.
Well, yeah,
there wasn't much left.
I think you even described that you could see her still beating heart through the hole in her chest.
Yeah, that's usually a pretty good example of you're going to die, okay? So I don't think Dahlia thought twice about it, other than why would I end the misery of that witch?
Okay.
No, yeah, and like Jason, right? She stands up as soon as the
sure.
No. She's a broken woman.
Yeah, but you can be broken and still be a threat.
Hey, you never know. It is.
I guess my last question, and then we'll see if Tracy's at. But my last question is the journey of Drizzt. He's been through 700 books at this point, right?
704.
704. Okay.
Yeah. No. I think if you count in the Stone of Tomorrow books, if
right.
you count the Cleric Quintet as Drizzt books, which I do.
Okay.
If you count the War of the Spider Queen as Drizzt books, which I don't.
Okay.
I think the number's in nearing mid-30s now.
And that's if you don't include the comics.
Well, there's five comics, but it's one little adventure.
Right.
More like a short story than a novel.
So I guess my curiosity is about Drizzt's journey. Like, what is his... Like, do you have a vision of you know, this is where he started as a person and this is where he's going? Because he's always facing new challenges, but a lot of his inner monologue continues to sort of be very consistent, you know, in terms of the way he thinks about things. And you give us those little journal entries or what have you before each book. And it seems like he mentally and emotionally addresses the problems of each book in very similar ways. And I'm kind of curious where his journey is. Do you have an idea, I guess, of where his journey is taking him?
I do. And there's two things about that. One is when you read those journal entries, people say, oh, he's being preachy. But he's not, because he's not talking to you. He's talking to himself. That's his internal dialogue, trying to reaffirm what he believes to be the truths of the world or make sense of things he can't make sense of. So start with that. But yeah, I mean, Drizzt's character is consistent because do people really change all that much? I mean, externally, yes, but internally, do people, if you knew someone in high school who rescued a kitten out of the tree at great personal risk, do you think you'd find that person kicking a cat 20 years later? I don't think the moral compass moves all that far in people. They might find justifications to get around it, but as far as knowing what's right and wrong, I think we know that. And we have that ingrained in us. And to different degrees, and maybe with different perspectives. But Drizzt is someone whose moral compass, his internal guide, was firmly established in the earliest days of his life. I mean, in the first book, when he was faced with the reality, he couldn't do it. He could not live in that society. That moral compass is not going to suddenly change. And Trary and Dahlia might bring him to do some things that he normally wouldn't do, but the internal guidance will still be there. He'll know it's wrong if he's doing wrong. And I think that's true of most people. I don't think people change all that much.
Okay.
In terms of moral compass, in terms of how they view the world. I mean, a trauma can make somebody be an angrier person. But that anger is nothing more than a cry for help in most cases, right? So from where I'm sitting, and this is what people say to me, it goes, what's the character development of Dritz in this book? You know, after all these books in more than 20, almost a quarter of a century now, writing about him, and him being going from birth to 200 years old, I don't know that there's going to be a lot of what you would call classic character development at this point. It's more like if I put pressure on the character of Dritz, how will he react to it? Can I get him to do things he wouldn't normally do? Or can I get him to reaffirm that which he held dear all these years? Those are the questions more than where am I taking the character? Because he's formed character. He's a fully formed character. For people who have been with the series from the beginning, if they don't know who this guy is by now, I give up.
Okay. Very good.
So, yeah, he's consistent. And he'll remain. His actions might not remain consistent, but that internal, you know, warning light will be bleeping. He may choose to ignore it, but it'll be there.
Okay. Tracy, any last questions?
Well, I can't think of anything.
Okay. Well, then I want to thank you for coming on again. It was good to talk to you.
Nice talking to you, too.
And we'll do this again next year. Do we know the title of the new book?
Well, I know my title, but they won't go with it.
Is it continuing? I assume it's continuing in the Neverwinter region, since that's the name of the trilogy, right?
Well, there's still a lot of unfinished business there, as we saw at the end of Neverwinter, right?
Yeah, you bet.
I mean, what happened to Dahlia at the end of Neverwinter? Artemis and Trey mentioned the name, remember?
Yeah, oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think it's a safe bet that we're going to stick around for a little longer.
So we're back on the revenge story, huh?
Hey, you know,
seems
it
like
drives them down the road.
Seems
what
like
can I say?
Seems like that's her big motivation in life is who do I need revenge on next?
Well, did you read her backstory in Gone to
Prem? Oh yeah,
she's an angry gal.
Oh yeah,
with reason.
You bet. All right. Thanks for joining us.
Okay, you take care.
Yep, you too.
Bye, Tracy.
Bye.
We are back, and before we jump into the rest of it, we did want to mention our second sponsor of the episode, Sentinels of the Multiverse by Greater Than Games. It is a cooperative superhero card game. So you pick out your hero, and everybody on the table has a hero. I think it was up to, what, 5 players? And then you team up together against the villain, but there's several different villains and several different heroes, so every time you play, you can get a different experience. So you should check that out. SentinelsOfTheMultiverse.com.
Greater Than Games is all about making the games that we've always wanted to play. We love playing games, and we love our ridiculous process of game creation. The most important thing to us is to make the sorts of games we want to play available to everyone. Go to SentinelsOfTheMultiverse.com for more information.
And now it's time for us to finish our conversation about Neverwinter by R.A. Salvatore, who you just finished hearing us talk to, and that was awesome. It's always fun to be able to talk to a veteran like Mr. Salvatore and get his take on how he does what he does.
And you guys totally geeked out on Realm stuff, which was cool.
Yeah, well, some of us in the interview had things to talk about, and others didn't, and so we talked about whatever we wanted to. And
I wish it's in over my head. You guys know way more than I do about the realms, and what was I going to talk about?
Well, that's part of why you're here, is to bring us the perspective of somebody who doesn't have that background. Tracy.
I try.
But you asked your question.
I did.
I don't remember what it was, so it must not have been very important, but
I asked why Dahlia got diminished.
Oh, yeah. That's right. You stomped on his heart there.
I did.
And told him that his new favorite character is not important.
Well, I do like I do like what he said about how she might become important if she lives long enough.
Well, right. I think that was just him. I think what he was saying is, Intrieri and Driss have been around long enough that they are legends, you know, people know them, and it's sort of the Batman effect, you know, the idea that they show up on the scene and people freak out a little bit. whereas Dahlia doesn't have that legend, and especially to Sylora. Sylora knew her intimately, and so there wasn't that intimidation factor there. That didn't exist for them. And so what he was saying is that, you know, with time, if she doesn't die, because, you know, any characters could die at some point, right? You know, with time, she could develop a legend of her own and be intimidating to people as well.
Although it's funny, because apparently a fair number of people in the area do know her. Or of her reputation.
Well, I mean, she's been fairly prominent in the last, year or two, as the last couple of books have been going on, yeah.
Yeah, because the guys in the woods know... I think it's the guys in the woods who know her. That there's some comment about Dritz learning things and kind of guffaw... like, laughter as... they say, oh, yeah, we're sure you're going to teach him some stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, and those people in the woods, as well as Sylora and Valindra and all these other people, have not been in Neverwinter for very long. And in fact, in fairness, nobody's been in Neverwinter for very long.
Right.
I mean, I think that's part of the purpose of the setting, both the campaign setting and... the setting that he's using it for in the book and all that, or the books and all that, is that they've very purposely set up a scenario where pretty much everybody's new to town. Like, there's nobody in the entire region that's been there for very long. Because there was a massive cataclysm that killed everybody except for Barabbas in the previous book.
Well, how does whatchamacallit know that the bridge is going to be named after him? Or does he make that up?
How does who's well by who, whom do you mean? Whatchamacallit?
What's his name?
Barabbas or
Herzog? Allegri?
Allegni?
Herzog? Allegni, yeah.
In the previous book, when it started, he had been sort of building a relationship with the people of Neverwinter, and sort of like he was trying to do in this book, right? He was trying to make himself the hero, even though he's secretly the bad guy.
Yeah.
And so he had sort of gotten to that point and manipulated things and actually threatened the leadership of the town to a point that he forced them to sort of he was getting more and more influence and more control in the city, and then he forced them to name the bridge after him,
right?
Because it was like his favorite part of the bridge,
and so, it was like they were naming the bridge when the thing happened, right?
And they had just named the bridge after him,
right?
And then. Stuff happened and he disappeared from the city for a while, and everybody just sort of went back to calling it what they'd always called it. Like, it was named after him for all of like a week. And one of those things where it was named after him just long enough that nobody bothered to remember that that's what the name was, and they just went back to calling it what they've always called it for years.
Okay.
And then the catastrophe happened and everybody died, and they came back and said, well, it's a bridge with winged wyverns on it. We'll go back to calling it that.
Right.
And so that's what it was for a long time.
Yeah, because I thought they were naming it as the thing happened, because that's
it was yeah why. Just before.
Okay.
So, what other things did we hear in the interview that we wanted to discuss, or what other questions could I resolve for you?
You could tell me all of the Forgotten Realms lore.
Stuff happened, and then people had sex. That was pretty much everything you knew about the realms.
Oh, I knew that from this book, though.
Which is strange, right? The realms have always been a very sexy place, but usually not in Salvatore's books.
Right.
I think that's just Ed Greenwood's personal little perversion where he likes to have a little sex in everything.
Yeah.
And sometimes not a little.
I did like that there were even more instances where the nameless people were women.
Uh-huh.
That was cool. I like that a lot.
Yeah, you do like that.
Yeah.
And it's always made sense in the realms as well. And it never made sense to me whenever they would describe, you know, the guards people or whatever, and they were always all male. Never made sense with my understanding of the realms, which from the beginning has always been that the sexes are always equal. You know, well, if they're equal, then there wouldn't be a dominant sex or dominant gender or whatever in certain roles, and so
right. And well, that's what in the prologue, I think it's the prologue, it got me a little weird that Drist was he seemed to be acting more like he had to protect Dahlia because she was a woman,
mm-hmm.
sort of thing. And that's what I think got me as a little off guard, because I thought that the realms were pretty equal and where you wouldn't necessarily have that as much. But
well, but I don't know that it was, I need to protect her because she's a woman. I think it was more of a, I need to protect her because she's my companion, if not friend. Right. He's always been protecting people. Sometimes they've been, you know, his wife, and sometimes they've just been his good friends, but he's always been about protecting other people. So I think that might be where that's from. I don't think it was specifically because she's a woman.
Hmm.
Does that make sense? Or am I just,
yeah, justifying? I don't know. I have no idea. I mean, so like I said, this is my first real Dritz novel, and, I don't know. There are just certain parts of it, like constantly calling out that she was a woman, that made me, I don't know. I don't know how to explain it. But it also, your explanation also makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't have the perspective of being a woman either, so that's where you're useful here.
I'm not that useful.
Because you're the Tome Show's girl, right?
Right. Exactly.
Right.
So, were there other female characters in the first book?
I don't...
In the trilogy? You don't know, sure. Okay.
I don't think so. Not that I can think of. Certainly not that played prominently or were very important. I think all the major female characters that we have in this book, we basically met in the last book.
Right.
The characters that were missing from this book that were in the last one were some of the dwarves, and Bruinir and some of his crew that sort of followed him out of Mithril Hall when he faked his own death and retired. And they were all guys. And then Jarl Axel and Athergate, who are both male. So I think everybody that were missing from the previous book to this book were male.
Okay.
And we didn't introduce a lot of new characters in this book. I mean, we lost a lot of characters in the last one that didn't show up here, and we didn't introduce a lot of new ones. So he didn't continue to build a cast that was bigger and bigger, considering that he already had a pretty big cast with 17 different factions all aiming for 14 different goals.
Right. Yeah, no, I will admit that one of the hard parts I had in the book was trying to find a character that I really cared about.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, Dritz, as he's written, to me, seems like he embodies a lot of the ideals that boys tend to be raised with. Like, seeing the world more in black and white, and, mm-hmm. and always trying to do good, and defending the weak, and all those things. Which is cool, but isn't exactly how... It's not as easy for me to jump into that, in part because sometimes... things that seem chivalrous can kind of make life hard for me. But none of the women are, I mean, unless maybe you talk about the farmer's wife, are women who really speak to me. So,
although I really like that character. I mean,
the farmer's wife?
Yeah, I know she was just sort of there for a couple of scenes or whatever, but I actually really liked her.
Yeah, no, she was great. She's like, no, you're not going to come in here without at least talking mm-hmm. to me first.
And was a pretty darn strong person.
Oh, yeah.
You know, to be able to say there are these two obvious, you know, obviously tough people that could easily take me down if it came to that, right? And in a fight, they win. And yet she wasn't going to back down to these legends walking down her stoop at all, riding a unicorn of all things. And she's going to sit there and stand up to him, you know?
Oh, totally.
I really liked her.
And she's like, go get the brewer.
Mm-hmm.
And she sends off for him, and then they try to cut off Dahlia's leg. And
on one hand, that was one of my favorite scenes. Is the scenes dealing with them, and how do you deal with these moral issues with the common people and all that who are trying to scratch out a living and survive, but do it in the right way.
Right.
But at the same time, these are not necessarily the stories that I particularly expected. Right? Because Driss is not a heroic tier character, if you want to put it into 4th edition terms, right?
Right.
He hasn't been... I mean, in the previous book, he was involved in a fight with a primordial. This is at best mid to upper Paragon tier, you know?
Right.
And so him having to deal with relatively mundane things like that doesn't exactly fit to me. Like, it was really interesting, and I really liked the some of the character interactions and what was going on there. But at the same time, I'm like, wait a minute. Really? Like,
well, doesn't
why can't he just do these things?
Well, doesn't it reveal his weaknesses, though? I mean, his main thing is that he's a warrior, but he doesn't really get ordinary people a lot of times. Although in this particular case, he does. He does understand why, you know, the whole book, Delia is trying to explain to him how ordinary people live and how they view the world, and Driss isn't getting it. And then you have this one case where Delia is about to lose her foot, and she totally can't understand why these people might do this to her. And Driss is the only one who can really explain it, even though she doesn't necessarily buy it. But
yeah, and it's actually what you've made me think about as you talk about all that is that in a lot of ways, Drist was remembering, you know, maybe as this upper level character, right? He's remembering that it doesn't matter. The little people are still important, which is one of those things as a DM, I'd like my epic tier characters to remember that just because you're epic tier and dealing with gods doesn't mean that people aren't important.
Right.
Because sometimes it's easy to forget that. Whereas Delia was the other person, right? She was the person saying, well, I don't care about these people. They are too far beneath me to even bother considering, you know? They're useful to me at this time, but they're not important. They're just nameless NPCs that aren't going to be important in the larger storyline. That, you know, that was sort of her attitude.
Right.
So I guess that works for me. And it betrayed Drist going back a little bit into some of his roots and remembering who's really important in all this.
Right. Well, and it's hard, you know, to keep that outlook when you don't have any friends left, which is almost where Drizzt is at. I mean, he's got Delia, but
yeah, I don't know that I count her as a friend.
Right. Delia is Delia. I mean, we talked about moving the diamond over to the other ear sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have.
I think he considers her a friend. I don't know if she considers him back, but I think he's quick to make friends.
Right.
I think he always wants to see the best in people. And in fairness, there has been a theme throughout all of the books that he tries to see the best in people, or situations force him to see the best in people, and they oftentimes start to move in his direction. Like Salvatore mentioned in our discussion that one of the things he's exploring is what happens when Drist is working with companions that don't have the same moral compass as him. But in a lot of ways, he's explored that story before. I mean, Drist has been forced to work with Artemis and Truri a few times in the past, right? They've teamed up. This isn't the first time they've teamed up. And they've explored a little bit of that. And typically what happens is the other person's moral compass starts to move. And we're seeing that again here, right? Delia starts off when she's first introduced as very self-serving, very evil. And her instinct is still sort of in that direction, but she's moving in the other way, right? She's doing more and more good things because she's around him.
Right.
In the same way that Artemis, you know, started off as an angry, you know, killer way back when he was first introduced in like the, fourth book in this whole series. And then in this one, he at one point jumps out to be the hero to help save Neverwinter and enjoyed being the hero. You know, his internal monologue made it seem like he almost enjoyed doing it because he was saving people. You know, he was doing things for them because he knew they couldn't do it himself. So.
Although it is funny how he's getting a real thrill out of certain things. Because you mentioned that a few times too, right?
What certain things is he getting thrill out of?
Oh God, what was it? There were a few times when he was on his unicorn. There's at least once when he's on his unicorn that he's just talking about. He has this overwhelming sense of exhilaration.
Oh, with Drist.
Yeah, with Drist, sorry.
Yeah. I thought you were talking about Artemis thinking that. Yeah, no. Drist does. Yeah, they make a point. I think that's one of the themes is that he's starting to find, you know, it's been a while now, and he's starting, since he's been a real adventurer, and he's starting to find the joy in being an adventurer again is sort of how I read that, right? He's enjoying sort of being on the edge and putting himself in danger and taking those risks, but at the same time approaching it with that full confidence that he's going to come out of it, you know? Just like when you're playing D&D, I mean, that's what it's all about, right? you're throwing yourself into really stupid, dangerous situations with the full confidence that somehow it'll all work out in the end.
I don't know. I usually play lower level characters. Not always sure it's going to work out when I throw my character, you know, off a 50-foot cliff. That was fun at first level.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Was that the spider incident?
Yeah, it was a spider incident. Onto the back of a humongous spider.
In any case, anything else to talk about? Because we've got about 40 minutes with Mr. Salvatore, and we've got about 40 minutes of us chit-chatting, so this is going to be like the longest book club episode ever.
I think I'm fine.
Okay. You're fine?
I'm fine.
You're going to be okay? We've talked you down now?
Sure.
Okay. Well, good. But certainly, this was a fairly typical, I think, sort of middle part of a trilogy in a Driss story, given that it's in a new set of characters and a new story and a new time frame. So I think it's interesting to check out, and I think some of the supporting cast have a lot of potential to go interesting places. So that's my take.
And okay.
Tracy wishes she had more background because it would make more sense.
Maybe.
Or maybe not. Tracy's ready for a break. And I think we're going to take a break. In the next book club, the holidays are coming up and I'm crazy busy. And I know you've been pretty crazy busy with work and stuff as well. So in the next book club, we're going to merge November and December into one book club. Right?
Woohoo. Yeah.
Okay. And then we're also going to... really take a load off of ourselves, and instead of looking at a book, we're going to do a book club on comic books, right?
Yeah.
How did you want to do that? I mean, did you want to do just the first 12? That's one big arc. It was the first 12 issues.
Okay.
Issue 13 just came out like last week. And it starts a new arc, and by the time we're done, ready to record, right, they're going to be sort of in the middle of that story arc, I think. So it might be good just to do one story arc and do issues 1 through 12.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
Okay. So we will talk about the Dungeons & Dragons comic, the IDW comic, not the Dark Sun one and not the Drist one, but we're doing something for the book club that's not Forgotten Realms.
But you have to explain comics to me.
It's pictures and words.
I know.
What do you want me to explain? And if you're reading it on your iPad, it even tells you what panel to read next. It moves for you.
Really? Nice. Uh-huh.
It's actually pretty cool. I like it. In any case, so we're going to look at comics. Issues 1 through 12, available through the IDW app, as well as the Comixology comics app, available on Android and iOS devices, as well as I think you can get them and read it through the web as well. So anybody can read along. And I don't know if we're going to be able to get an author in on this one. The author of the comic series is also the author of Leverage, or the writer for Leverage.
Oh, man.
So it's a pretty big name, or at least, you know, a relatively busy guy. And I don't know that we're going to be able to pull that off. But I'll send some emails off to IDW and see what they say.
And definitely follow him on Twitter.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, that's that. We want to thank our sponsors, Noble Knight Games and Sentinels of the Multiverse, as well as our guest, R.I. Salvatore. It's always interesting to chat with him and see where he's coming from on this long-standing character.
Totally. And if you have any questions, concerns, comments about... this episode or any others, you can email us at thetomeshow@gmail.com or check in on the forums at gamershavenpodcast.com. And finally, you could call and we might even play it in an episode, our biz line at 919-BIZ-TOME. That's 919-BIZ-TOME.
We haven't been playing those nearly enough. We need to do that sometime.
Totally.
Right on. And if anybody wants to find show notes on this episode, they can go to thetomeshow.com, and we'll have links to stuff there. So this has been Neverwinter, the Neverwinter episode of the Tome Show Book Club. We've wandered the woods and fought with pirates and almost cut off Tracy's leg.
And we figured out that you should always kill the person.
Yeah, I don't know what you're thinking. If... If the bad guy's there that you've been trying to kill for the entire story is laying at your feet, finish the job. I don't care how dead she looks.
Finish her.
That's right. So join us next time as we discuss issues 1 through 12 of the Dungeons & Dragons comic book from IDW. Goodbye.
I'm on the wall.